overarching theme for today's class is the discipline of simplicity. Okay, so grab devotional classics and turn to Jeremy Taylor. Jeremy Taylor was an Anglican bishop living in the 17th century. And I want you to take a good look at two sections, section one and section two. Section one and section two. In section one, he gives a definition of humility, and his definition is having a realistic opinion of yourself. Having a realistic opinion of yourself, we are not as bright and as gifted and as loving as we might think we are, on the one hand, and we're not as awful as we tend to think we are, on the other hand. Humility is a realistic opinion. So he writes this, it's pretty good stuff. Have a realistic opinion of yourself. He says this. He's got a sense of humor, by the way. He says, don't think better of yourself because of any outward circumstance that happens to you. Don't think better of yourself because of something that's happened externally, circumstantially. It's all under the providence of God. Some of us are born into poverty. Some of us, for instance, are born into wealth. Don't think of yourself more highly because of that outward circumstance. Although you may, because of the gifts that have been bestowed upon you, be better at something than someone else, as one horse runs faster than another. Know that it's for the benefit of others, not yourselves. So what we've been given, Taylor is stressing, is on behalf of another person or another group, not ourselves. And then this is a good word. He says, humility does not consist in criticizing yourself. We'll develop this this morning. It doesn't consist in criticizing yourself or wearing ragged clothes. So one is an internal attitude and the other is an external attitude. Or walking around submissively wherever you go. In a manner of speaking, humility is telling the truth to yourself about yourself. It's just telling the truth to yourself about yourself. You are all gifted. And you've all got serious problems to work through, just like me. It's telling the truth, humility, telling the truth about yourself, having a realistic opinion. Now, the second thing that really, both of these, a number of these points that Taylor is making tie in with the discipline of simplicity. Take a good look at section two here, for example, where he says, do good things in secret. He encourages us to do good things in secret so that our motivation in doing good things is not to make an impression upon other people, not to gain another person's praise or adulation in some way. He'll make one other point before that one. Third, when you hold this opinion of yourself, that's a realistic self-estimation, right? When you hold this opinion of yourself, be content that others think the same of you. If you realize that you're not wise, don't be angry if someone else should agree. It's fairly abrupt and kind of funny. If you truly hold this opinion of yourself, you should also desire that others hold this opinion as well. You'd be a hypocrite to think lowly of yourself, but expect others to think highly of yourself. Don't you think? So just have that realistic opinion. And it's by the way, it's tremendously freeing, as we'll see from Ortberg in just a second, tremendously freeing. Now, his fourth principle, he says, nurture a love to do good things in secret. Nurture a love, meaning fertilize a love, water a love, care for a love, to do things in secret, to do good things in secret. Again, this works at snapping that tendency within all of us to act and speak in such a way to create impressions for other people to see and then be attracted to. He wants to free us. See, the discipline of simplicity is immensely freeing. He wants to free us from other people's opinions, for instance. So he says, nurture a love to do good things in secret, concealed from the eyes of others, and therefore not highly esteemed because of them. Be content to go without praise. It's a good word. Be content to go without praise. Can you sense how freeing that would be? If we're content to go without praise, we're not concerned, nearly as concerned about what other people are thinking of us. Now, in light of that, we'll be back in devotional classics in a few minutes, but I want you to grab Ortberg's book. He has a chapter in this text on what he calls the discipline of secrecy. He's got an entire chapter here on the discipline of secrecy, as he calls it, the practice of secrecy. This is chapter 10. And there are three phrases from this chapter I'd like you to remember and perhaps journal about and ponder, meditate upon. First phrase is this, and then we'll walk together through these. First phrase is addiction approval. Addiction approval. No, I got it backwards. I'm dyslexic. That's not right. I'm almost sure that's not right. Did that sound right to you? It's not right. So all of you who were dyslexic, be free. It's approval addiction. Approval addiction. I'm almost sure that's right. I have to turn the page and look here. Yep. Approval addiction. Jeez. I think this next one is right. Generalized other. And the third one is impression management. So we have approval addiction. Why is it, he writes on page 158, why is it, now think of Taylor too at this point, why is it that we often respond so strongly to criticism? How do you find yourself responding when someone criticizes you? Or when you hear that somebody has been critical of you? What kind of response does that elicit? He says here, our response to criticism reveals a secret addiction in many of us. This addiction has nothing to do with chemical dependency, substance abuse. There's no 12-step groups to help people fight it, nor any Betty Ford treatment centers in which to detoxify. Now, here's what it is. I refer to what might be called approval addiction. Next line, so key. Some people live in bondage to what other people think of them. I think that's true. This is why the discipline of simplicity leads to freedom. Some people live in bondage to what other people think of them. Now, that's something you could journal about. How deeply is my own understanding of who I am in terms of my strengths and weaknesses wedded, joined to what other people think of me? Am I addicted to what other people think of me? Do I dress in light of what other people might think of me? However I might choose to dress, do I choose my words in terms of the impression they can make on another person? Approval addiction. He says the addiction takes many forms. If we find ourselves getting hurt, often getting hurt, adverb important, if we find ourselves often getting hurt by what others say about us, by people expressing other than glowing opinions about us, we probably have it. Approval addiction. If we habitually compare ourselves with other people, if we find ourselves getting competitive in the most ordinary situations, we probably have it. If we live, now think about this one for a minute. These are hard, because I think we all struggle to a certain extent with approval addiction. So he says here, if we live with a nagging sense we aren't important enough, a nagging sense we aren't important enough or special enough. Or we get envious of another's success. We probably have it. If we keep trying to impress important people? We probably haven't. So first of all, I think the first step towards healing is to admit, all right, perhaps I am addicted to other people's approval. So we have approval addiction. Now, second phrase, turn over to this would be page 161. Approval addiction is linked to what one sociologist, George Herbert Mead, calls our generalized other. Our generalized other, I want you to know that phrase, our generalized other. Now, here's what it is. Let's chuckle at it rather than move into deep despair. Our generalized other, here's what it is. The mental representation we carry inside ourselves, so it's a mental representation, we carry it inside ourselves of that group of people in whose judgment we measure our success or failure. Who's the group of people in terms of which you measure your success or failure? And he expands upon this. He talks about a mental jury box. A mental jury box. And in that mental jury box, can you see them in your mind's eye? Can you see you're in a courtroom, living your life in a courtroom, and there's a jury box, and in that jury box are the people upon whom you depend for their approval as to whether you are a valuable, worthy person or not. Your mental jury box, that's your generalized other. Now, that's a very tough journal entry, is to acknowledge who those people are. For each one of us, we can put two people there right away, and that's our parents. Then we can add on others. For some people, it might be a given professor. For some people, it might be friends. Family members, people in the community, who's in that jury box? Now, the interesting thing about the people in the jury box, oftentimes the people we have in the jury box are really not paying all that much attention to us. You know, they're really not all that concerned. We think that they're thinking about us and looking at us and judging us, and so we're acting accordingly, trying to gain their approval, and they're thinking about the Yankees game. They're not thinking about us. Actually, it comes to mind, my father was surely in my mental jury box. I mean, I loved him deeply, but he was tough. In fact, at his funeral, my older brother said he was the toughest person he had ever met. My older brother speaking. So here's my father. I used to have a phobic response to flying. It's gotten better with the help of counseling, taking a course on flying, and medication. So it's better. So I'm able to go places now that without, you know, going into deep psychiatric distress. Well, that's great, really wonderful, if your father was flying dive bombers off the Lexington when he was 18. And he's got a son who's afraid to fly. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I can remember when I was in school as an undergrad out in California, I had in the back of my mind, so he's in my mental jury box, right? And I had in the back of my mind, for some reason, that he wanted me to become a medical doctor. Because everybody in my family's a medical doctor. Uncles, medical doctors, cousins, medical doctors, one psychiatrist. Surely, to please my dad, I've got to be a medical doctor. The only problem is I don't want to be a medical doctor. So my first quarter at UCLA, I'm taking all kinds of courses that I absolutely hate. I don't like the smells. I don't like the labs. I don't like the math. I don't like any of it. So I decide at the end of my first quarter, I'm going to transfer because I'm so frustrated by what's going on. And I know I'm going to have to call him up. He's in Virginia. I'm going to have to call him up and explain why I'm transferring from UCLA to somewhere else. So I called him up. This has to do with the jury box and people in the jury box sometimes not being as concerned as one might think. And I said, it's always just a tinge intimidating to talk to him. And I said, Dad, I'm going to be transferring. Oh, why are you going to be doing that? I don't like UCLA. Oh, what don't you like about it? Oh, it's too big. Too big. I want to be at a smaller school, make more friends easily. Oh, all right. Anything else? Pause. Do I tell the truth or not? So I blurted out, I don't want to be a doctor. And then he would use this term with great love. Well, you knucklehead. Whoever told you had to be a doctor? You don't want me to be a doctor? When did I ever say that I want you to be a doctor? I want you to be what you want to be. Really? Yeah. Kind of this confused voice on the other end of the phone. Yeah. Really? Yeah. Almost like, hello? Yeah. In his own kind of inimical, bold, gruff way. And I said, oh. Well, are you going to be transferring from UCLA? No. I shudder to wonder what he was thinking at that point. But you know, I think actually, it comes to mind, I think I talked about that experience at his funeral with his body lying in front of me. And I said at that funeral, that was a gift of grace that he gave to me. I was able to move him out of the jury box. Because what is the conversation length? And one of the things he said to me was, I will be happy with you as long as you're doing what you want to do and feel good at doing. That's a gift, is it not? I think what he was saying was, my love for you is not predicated on what you do. You're my boy. So, who's in the jury box? So we have this question of approval addiction, which the discipline of simplicity can free us from. We've got the issue of the generalized other. Who's in your jury box, and how can you move them out? It might be, for example, it might be that there are some conversations that need to take place. I don't know. And you know what? You can always have conversations with somebody even after they're dead by writing a letter and taking the letter and going out to where they're buried and place the letter on that gravesite. You can always talk to them. Freedom is always possible from some of the things that have deeply troubled us or people who've deeply troubled us. So we have generalized other, and then what's the third? The third has to do with, what was the one I mentioned to you? Impression management, that's right, impression management. All right, so we have our generalized other, and then if you turn to page 169, he mentions impression management. I'll give you the illustration he gives in just a moment, but here's impression management. I still distinctly remember this. When I was in the pastorate over in France, and a worship service had taken place in the sanctuary, and it was over, and people were coming up, as they often do, and talking, and a woman came up to me, and she said, Chris, while I was vacuuming the sanctuary the other day, this question came to mind. I still remember it. Isn't that strange how you remember certain things? As I was vacuuming the sanctuary the other day, this question came to mind. And I thought to myself, why did she tell me she was vacuuming the sanctuary? That's impression management. That's impression management. Or as Ortberg puts it here, top of page 169, we can give up trying to control what other people think of us. We can give up the whole business of trying to convince them that our motives are pure, that our accomplishments are impressive, or that our life is in better shape than it seems. So he says, resign from impression management. The technical term for this habit is impression management. If we take notice, we'll see that a vast amount of what we say generally includes a great deal of impression management. For instance, if we tell someone about a television program, we may preface our report with a disclaimer. A disclaimer. I don't watch TV much, but the other night, you ever use those kind of disclaimers? That's impression management. Because we surely, as he puts it here, we surely don't want someone to think that we're sitting at home tossing down chocolate bonbons and watching mediocre sitcoms. We don't want anybody to think that. So I don't watch much TV. I happen to be, cruising through one evening out of 45 and came across ... Why do we do this? There's a question. You might think about that. You might journal about it. Why do we impression manage? How much television we watch has nothing to do with what we're about to say, so why do we throw in that information or that disclaimer? This is merely an exercise in impression management. He goes on and he says, college students play the same game. The most common comment before a test or after it's been graded and returned is, I hardly even studied for it. Why do students say that? They want to make sure that others know that a potential bad grade on the test is no reflection of their intelligence. That is, if they had studied as expected, they would have done better. Food for thought, impression management. So if you take a look at 170, 171, and so on, here you have a writer in the 21st century, late 20th, early 21st, actually reinforcing what Jeremy Taylor was saying back in the 17th century. Can you see it there in 170, 171? Because this whole chapter of Ortberg's is about doing things in secret. It's a spiritual discipline. A spiritual discipline. He calls it the practice of secrecy. Taylor just simply encourages us to do this. And it's a discipline. It's somewhat artificial at the beginning. It can be disciplines can be like that. All right, the discipline of secrecy might entail something like this. You do something for that person, and you never, ever tell them. Ever. Or there's somebody who's up in the jury box. Impression management is going on. Approval addiction is going on. You know what's going on. And you do something for one of those people who you just with all your heart want to tell them so that they'll say, you're a good person. I love you lots. Look what you did for me. How could you do such a thing? And we just suck it in like a sponge. But in this particular case, it's not the best thing to be a sponge at that particular moment. I'm not saying that receiving love from others is not a good thing. But if it's connected to this kind of addiction, it needs to be bridled, that desire. It needs to be disciplined. So at that point in time, we do something for someone who we deeply desire to impress, and we never, ever say a word. And what it does within us is slowly but surely extinguishes that need for approval. Slowly. But surely. It's a classical spiritual discipline practiced within the church for hundreds of years. You can see how it would be a discipline, right? Because we'd have to really be disciplined, because we're all deeply fallen, but I'm deeply fallen, and left to myself, I'd be figuring out all kinds of subtle ways to communicate that I was the one who had really done something. But see, the result of the discipline of simplicity is freedom. Freedom. We stay, it's not like any of these relationships are stopping. We, for the most part, unless it's an abusive relationship, for the most part, we really love those people in that jury box. That's why they're there. We love them. But something's become unhealthy. So wouldn't it be wonderful to be freed from people's expectations in that sense of constantly trying to gain their approval so that our life is sometimes validated? So again, I ask the question, who are the people you're looking to for that kind of validation? Write their names down. Pray through it. And the result is freedom. I think this is one of the reasons public speaking is the number one fear of North Americans. And why do you think? Because when you're speaking publicly, you're so exposed. And people are judging what you're saying. And you can make all kinds of mistakes. And then what are they going to think? And that's why I don't want to get up. I don't want to expose myself that way. And if God's given you a gift for public speaking, you got to get up. But freedom comes in the discipline of simplicity and secrecy. All right, back to the discipline of simplicity in a different way. Turn over to Elizabeth O'Connor. The entire selection in devotional classics has to do with how to handle money well. How to handle money well, and handling money well is related to the discipline of simplicity in this way. The discipline of simplicity is all about trust. Trust. Who are we going to trust? What are we going to trust? And the tendency of fallen human beings is to trust, for their sense of security and well-being, how much they're making, how much money they have, and what that money can attain so that we can buy something, and by buying it, guess what? Impress somebody else. Why in the world would somebody spend $12,000 on a wristwatch? Why? So that somebody else could see that wristwatch on their wrist and think something. My, it's a Rolex. That person must be dot, dot, dot. My father, as a joke one Christmas, gave us all Rolex watches. And I opened this up and I thought, what are you, Dad? And then 5 minutes later, he's laughing. He says, oh, it's a fake Rolex. I got it in Asia. It cost me $20. But isn't that strange, though, when you take a step back and you think about how much we will spend on something, not because of the innate worth of whatever it is, but because of the impression we'll elicit from somebody else. You ever find yourself doing that? Or trusting deeply in what you possess for your sense of who you are, or your sense of safety, or your sense of security. If you take a look at, sections 1 and 2 for Elizabeth here. And she mentions in section 2, proportionate giving. So for O'Connor, the bottom line, from her perspective, the bottom line for all giving is 10% of your gross income. 10% of your gross income, that's income before deductions and so on. And then she talks about proportionate giving on top of that. She writes this. This is a section 2. None of us has to be an accountant to know what 10% of a gross income is, but each of us has to be a person on his knees before God if we're to understand our commitment to proportionate giving. Proportionate giving. Proportionate to what? Proportionate to the accumulated wealth of one's family? Proportionate to one's income and the demands upon it, which vary from family to family, and so on. I want you to think that one through. Because I think that there's probably a number of North Americans, because we're the very, very wealthy country, even when the economy's in recession, we're kings compared to a lot of people in a lot of places. I think there comes a time when you could probably give away everything that comes in, or a much, much higher proportion of what's coming in. We would want to do it wisely and prayerfully, but also proportionately. If someone's making $1 million a year, for example, I don't know that we all will be making $1 million a year, but say, just for the sake of illustration, such a thing was to happen. All right, 10% of $1 million is what? It's $100,000. $900,000 still left over there. Her point is this. Once you bought a house and you have transportation and you got clothes in the closet and so on and so forth, you don't need $900,000. It might be given to you by God for a greater purpose or reason. She's not saying that we stop creating wealth. The creation of wealth is a wondrous thing. But she is saying, think through proportionately what's coming in, with 10% as the bottom line. Let's keep moving here. Okay, over to Wesley. Now, we're going to move away from simplicity for just a moment and talk a little bit about the discipline of confession. And the discipline of confession will be the heart and core of class on Thursday. My definition of confession is naming something for what it is. I think I've said that before in class. Naming something for what it is. And Wesley, I won't say much about Wesley, you all know who he was. So he's living in the 18th century and the founder of the Methodist Church, John Wesley. I want you to be able to distinguish. Read section four. And I want you to be able to distinguish between sins of commission and sins of omission. Now, many of us from liturgical traditions would understand the difference, but I think it's important to remind ourselves. Sins of commission, sins of omission. And you can see from the chapter heading here the danger of sins of omission from Wesley's perspective in section four. All right, sins of commission are things that I have done that are sinful. I've committed act A, or I committed act B, or thought act C. That's a sin of commission. It's something I've actively done. Wesley's point, however, is that we will oftentimes focus on those things that we have done and forget those things that we have not done that we should have done. Equally serious. Those things that we have not done that we should have done. That's a sin of omission. So, Lord, forgive me for those things that I've done and those things that I have left undone. And it's very interesting in different liturgies, when we get to those things that are left undone, sins of omission, the liturgy continues and lists them. Lists the sins of omission. I have not loved my neighbor with my whole heart. I have not loved you as I've loved myself. Those are sins of omission. And it goes on, I am truly sorry, and I humbly repent. I humbly repent. For the sake of your Son, Jesus Christ, have mercy on me and forgive me. Now, that's a tough journaling exercise, but if you're looking for stuff, who knows, you might be a little behind. If you're looking for stuff, could happen. If you're a little bit behind, have one entry, and you talk about sins of commission. Staple it shut. Those are the things that, you know, you're just sinning away in some area, and you know it. But have another entry. This calls for deeper exploration. Have another entry where you talk to yourself about sins of omission. So it wouldn't surprise me if this very day God will bring someone or a situation into your life which is itself morally neutral. It's not positive, it's not negative, but there's a need that could be met by you, a word that could be said by you. And you know it, and you don't do it. That's a sin of omission. So you might journal about that. Bring it all to Christ, cover it all with the grace of God, and then maybe some good work can be done. Sins of omission. All right, now Catherine of Siena. She's a very interesting person. At the age of seven, she took a vow of virginity. And I believe it was the age of 14, that at the age of 14, let me look here. If at age of 15, she cut off her hair in defiance of her parents' efforts to see her married. At 18, she became a Dominican nun, began to live in solitude and silence, going out of her room only for Mass, and at age 21, decided to return to her family, spend her life helping the poor. Now, she's a very unusual woman. Not everybody does that kind of thing. But, you know, in her time and her place, God was speaking to her in a very interesting way. She only lived to be 33. And yet she's deeply loved by many, many people. Now, like a lot of these writers from her period, they'll use metaphors. Remember Teresa of Avila? And Teresa of Avila uses the metaphor of what? The castle, the interior castle. Catherine uses the metaphor of a bridge. It is a very vivid metaphor, almost shocking, because the bridge is a bridge with steps onto the cross. So Christ is on the cross. And the first, if you can imagine such thing, the first step is where we step up on the cross and place our feet upon his feet. So the second step, we can look into his side, very vivid, and see his heart beating. And the third step is so that we can embrace him mouth to mouth.
Phew.
That's very vivid. Almost, for some of, I can see the expressions. Let's read what the theological sense that she makes out of this kind of image. She says this, "I want to describe the bridge for you. It stretches from heaven to earth. By reason of my having joined myself with your humanity, which I formed in the earth's clay." Who's speaking? Christ is speaking, and he's speaking of his incarnation. His movement as the Son from heaven to earth, and in the incarnation taking upon human nature, which he formed from clay. We're back in Genesis chapter 2. "This bridge has three stairs. Two of them were built by my Son," now it's the Father speaking, "on the wood of the most holy cross, and the third, even as he tasted the bitterness of gall and vinegar they gave him to drink. You will recognize in these three stairs three spiritual stages. Number one, the first stair is the feet, which symbolize the affections, what we love. For just as the feet carry the body, the affections carry the soul." Now, we've seen that at least five or six times this semester. What we love moves the soul, manifests the soul. What we love determines the inclination of our will towards good or toward evil. So once again, the question of what do you love? And the danger, remember Richard Rohr? The danger of disordered loves. We can love things that are not lovable. That's the danger. So the first has to do with the affections. "My Son's nailed feet are a stair by which you can climb to his side, where you'll see revealed his inmost heart. For when the soul has looked up on the feet of affection, for when the soul has climbed up on the feet of affection and looked with her mind's eye into my Son's open heart, love blossoms." See, that's the point. It's not meant to be gruesome or so on, morbid. From a Roman Catholic perspective, the heart of Christ, you know, cut on the cross, is a manifestation of the love of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit to us. It's a deep manifestation of the love of God. And from Catherine's perspective, it's meant to ignite within us love. So she's inviting us with these three steps, this bridge, to embrace, in this case, the crucified Christ. All right, moving on here. Last one from Devotional Classics for today. Now we're in the 20th century with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. All right, you've heard from him any number of times this semester. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I want you to take a good look at section 2. And I would like you to know this phrase, alien righteousness. Alien righteousness. Now, here's the fundamental question. The fundamental question is, how can a fallen human being, like you or me, how can a fallen human being be in relationship with an infinitely righteous God? That's the question. And the only possibility is for God to do something to help us, to provide us with something that we do not have. And what we do not have in relationship with God, Bonhoeffer argues, is we don't have the righteousness we need to be in relationship with a righteous God. So in section 2, he talks about, asterisk now, he talks about alien righteousness. Alien righteousness. If you have devotional classics, take a look, and italicized in devotional classics is a Latin phrase, extra nos, extra nos. Extra nos in Latin means outside of ourselves. Extra, outside of, nos, ourselves, us, extra nos. And Bonhoeffer's point is this: God gives us an alien righteousness. It doesn't rise up within us. It's a gift that God gives to us. Make sense? It's a gift that God gives to us. It's something we desperately need, but we cannot produce it ourselves. Extra nos, alien righteousness. Okay, now, in 20 minutes, we're going to go through this overhead that has to do with simplicity. Okay, let's start off with some text. If you have a Bible, turn over to Matthew 6. Okay, this is from the Sermon on the Mount. I've highlighted a long passage from Matthew, and the key verse that I want to read to you is Matthew 6:33. Matthew 6:33 is at the heart of simplicity. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Can you see how the text from Bonhoeffer ties in at this point? Seek first his righteousness. Seek first his kingdom, and all of these other things will be given to you as well. And all of the other things that Jesus is talking about are the kinds of things that we become anxious about. As Jesus puts it, you become anxious about money. You become anxious about your clothes. Don't be anxious about these things. I'll provide what you need. He doesn't say, I will make you wealthy. He says, I will provide what you need, but seek first the kingdom of God and God's righteousness. That's the heart of simplicity. Simplicity clarifies our vision. Kierkegaard comes right in at this point. Purity of heart is to will one thing. And that one thing for Kierkegaard is what? Seek first the kingdom. So simplicity is a matter of allegiance. It's a discipline that has to do with our fundamental allegiances, our fundamental devotions, what's at the heart and core of what we're about. And I'm telling you, one of the reasons why money is so tied in with the discipline of simplicity, how we use our money, what we spend our money on, how much money we give away and so on, is very closely related to who we really are. To who we really are. We can't lie at that point. Take a look at Luke 12 up here. That's the story of the rich fool. And Jesus' comment after he's told the story of this man who had many barns and he was blessed and he tore down his barns saying to himself, ah, now I can relax, I'm safe, I'm secure for many years. And God says to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded of you. And then Jesus tells the parable, and then Jesus says this. This is the heart and core. A person's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. That's the heart of the matter. Our lives, the meaning of our lives do not consist in the abundance of our possessions. They don't. Let me add something here. The purpose and abundance of our life is determined by how well we love. That's what it's determined by. Nobody, except for those people who might be inheriting goods, nobody really at a funeral cares one whit about how much somebody was worth. Isn't it not true? What do they talk about? They talk about the meaning of somebody's life. And if there's not a lot said, there was not a lot of love present in that life. But if there was a lot of love, there's lots to be discussed and enjoyed. So like I said before, he who dies with the most toys wins is a stupid bumper sticker. He who dies with the most toys is dead, at least dead to this world. So a couple of other things. So we have with the discipline of simplicity. When you think duplicity, think of Ortberg's chapter on secrecy. Remember, the duplicitous person is the person who tries to live in two worlds simultaneously. Think of that illustration from Duffy Robbins. That's the person who has one standing on the dock and he's got his foot in a canoe and the canoe's moving away from the dock. You gotta make a decision. You can't live in two worlds anymore. You're gonna get wet. The duplicitous person is that spiritual chameleon whose color changes depending on the group he's with. Duplicity is the antonym for simplicity. The simple person is not someone who has a low intelligence quotient. The simple person is someone who's decided what she is about and has chosen to place the kingdom at the center of her being. And the kingdom being at the center determines her yeses and her noes. She's substantial. She's weighty. Moving on here. So I've already talked about that one. These are words you could journal about each one if you want to. What's at the focus of my life? To whom or what am I deeply attached? To whom am I giving my allegiance? To whom am I devoted? You could ask yourself the question, who would I die for? The early Christian community up to 310, when persecution finally stopped, thought about that a lot. Who would I die for? Because they were dying. It was always a possibility they'd be asked to give their life. Who would you die for? Moving on here. See, that's the heart. Point number four is the heart of simplicity. See, purity, Kierkegaard's word, if you remember, purity is something that's unmixed. It's unmixed. Our devotion is unmixed. It's uncontaminated. It's single-minded, single-hearted. All right, so we have two terms coming up here. The first is inner simplicity, and the next one on the overhead is external simplicity. Internal simplicity, external simplicity. You can think of a circle, and at the center of that circle is internal simplicity. What is internal simplicity? Seeking first the kingdom. That's what it is. It's saying to Jesus Christ, Lord, I wish to seek with a single eye your kingdom. So, internal simplicity comes first. We don't start talking about money or the kinds of cars we're going to drive or those kinds of issues first. We talk about to whom are we willing to give our allegiance. But, now here's the point, external simplicity flows out of internal simplicity. If I'm seeking first the kingdom, if that's at the heart and core of who I am, that allegiance, that focus, that devotion will reflect itself in how I choose to live concretely from day to day. You with me on that point? Does that make sense? One would naturally lead to the other. Now, this is one of the reasons why I find that health and wealth gospel so repulsive, to be direct. God does not promise us that we will be wealthy, but he promises us deep fulfillment, as we learn to love. So the dynamic would be, This is a fundamental principle of spiritual formation. The external is always rooted in the internal reality. The external is always rooted in the internal reality. The way that Jesus spoke of this was, by their fruit, you will know them. By their fruit, you will know them. What does he mean? A person might have a lot to say about what they believe. You'll be able to tell what they believe by how they behave. That's Christ. You'll be able to tell the truth of their words by how they're behaving. So inner simplicity, external simplicity. Now, see, we've seen this today. This spiritual discipline, whether it's the discipline of secrecy, as Ortberg calls it, or the discipline of simplicity, leads to freedom. Freedom from the self. So, for instance, we don't have to be incessantly clamoring for attention, applause, recognition, and so on. Let me ask you some questions. These are not from the book you're reading by Foster, but they're from a study guide. This will help us get a gauge by how deeply we're tyrannized by ourselves. And the first two just beat the heck out of professors. Number one, something like this: am I pretending to be an expert where I'm only an amateur? The operative word is pretending. Pretending. Am I pretending to be an expert where I'm only an amateur? How about something like this? Do I really read the books I quote? Whack. His point is, oftentimes we can be talking about books and expounding upon books, and we never cracked the cover. We just heard what somebody else said, or we read a review somewhere and said, oh, that's good, I can impress somebody with that. Pretending. Now, this next question, I think, is a helpful one. Do I give the impression of being more godly or more profane than I really am? That's interesting, because we thought we'd just stop with godly, right? Well, some of us do give an impression of being more godly than we really are, but some of us, depending upon the group that we're with, our colors change and we become more profane than we really are. That's duplicity. Foster writes this is a good one. Instead of becoming good, we resort to all sorts of devices to make people think we're good. That's duplicity. He says in his chapter on simplicity, stop trying to impress people with your clothes and impress them with your life. I like that. All right. Not only freedom from the tyranny of the self, but freedom from other people. Other people, the people in the jury box. When you, in your mind's eye, you're thinking, I'm not measuring up, freedom from those folks. Freedom from people. Some questions here. Can I allow an unfavorable comment about myself to simply pass?
No.
Can I allow an unfavorable comment about myself to simply pass? How about this one? In recounting events, do I shift the story to put myself in a more favorable light? To all of these, I would have to say yes. Yes, especially if I'm in trouble. Yes. Must I always make excuses for my behavior? Now, here's an interesting one. Can I accept compliments freely? You get that one? Can I accept compliments freely? Why do we have a hard time when someone compliments us? You know why? We don't want to seem to be ... That's pretending. I think the best thing to do is someone compliments you, say thank you, that just made my day. Last, freedom. Simplicity leads to freedom from things. Now here I mean freedom from ostentatious living. Freedom from buying something because of the impression it creates on another person or group of people. So again, at the heart of this is the question of trust and security. Can you see how? Freedom on the one hand, insecurity on the other. Here are the questions. And I leave you with these. Hang in with me now. Am I living within my income? And all of you say, of course we are. We're college students. We have no choice. But someday, you might have a choice. Am I living within my income? Here's one that we all can face. Am I a compulsive buyer? When things start to not go so well, do you head off to the mall? Just kind of wandering around there? I'd feel better. Oh, I can just feel it in the air. Happiness is in the air. I'm at the mall. How about this one? Guys, hang with me. I really have two more minutes. Do I act my age? Do I act my age? Thank goodness, you don't have to act like you're 58. You can act like you're 20, 21, 22. Do I act my age? See how pretending comes in? And finally, do I buy what I can afford and my responsibility to the poor suggests as appropriate? I have lost you. I realize that now. I admit it. It's okay. I'll see you on Thursday. Remember, study for the quiz, discipline of confession on Thursday.